The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
I'm Mo Rocca, and I've got a brand new podcast. It's all about the people who have long fascinated me. The one thing they've got in common? They're all dead. The name of my brand new podcast? Mobituaries. From the 20th century's greatest entertainer.
He was everything. I mean, he could play any instrument. He could dance like a maniac.
To the founding father, who just doesn't seem to get much respect.
This guy did everything wrong. So there's no statue, there's no signature on the Declaration of Independence.
You'll learn new things about people you thought you knew.
Were you aware that the day of your inauguration, Audrey Hepburn died?
No.
You'll learn about people who aren't real.
They did not have room in the writing for the older brother because the Fonz became the older brother.
So join me this premiere season of Mobituaries.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
A government funding breakthrough.
We have reached a deal.
Another indictment in the Russia probe.
I will plead not guilty.
Later, we talk to the New York Times 52 Places traveler.
I was working basically 24/7, so I didn't get a lot of free time.
And now, from the Capital One Bank studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend with a government shutdown.
I am very proud to announce today that we have reached a deal to end the shutdown and reopen the federal government.
That's President Trump speaking to reporters Friday from the Rose Garden. Let's go to White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Stephen, what was this breakthrough?
It seems, ultimately, the president decided to take yes for an answer, as Democrats would put it. The painful shutdown lasted 35 days. In the end, he accepted an offer that Democrats have been making since before the shutdown began, to reopen shuttered agencies while the talks on the wall continue. The conservatives that I follow on social media were very quick to describe it as a cave. They are not pleased with the president, and they worry about what this portends for the rest of his term, with Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House and Democrats able to block measures in the Senate.
What's the nuts and bolts of this deal?
Well, it's a clean 3-week extension of government funding through February 15th. It would allow agencies to reopen.
There was an ultimatum, though, that the president offered. What was that?
He says if Democrats do not agree to fund the wall between now and February 15th, either the government will shut down again, or he says he'll use the powers afforded to him under the Constitution and the law to address this emergency that he says exists on the border. That, again, was a suggestion that he will declare a national emergency to build the wall using unappropriated military construction funds. Up until now, he has said that he does not want to do that because he'd rather have Congress appropriate money. It's a whole lot easier if Congress were to do that. But lawyers who work in this White House have argued that the president has the statutory authority to move money around. The difficulty for him is that he'd get pushback from Republican lawmakers who have appropriated money for the projects that they want it to be spent on, including particular military construction projects.
This buys Congress, this buys the president some time, but how likely could it be that we end up in the same place we are right now next month?
Democrats are not going to budge from their position. And if this episode has taught them anything, it's that if they stick to their guns, well, then ultimately they'll get what they want. The president's negotiating style has been to create a bunch of chaos and then, as he has put it in his writing and in his statements, whine enough and he'll get what he wants. Well, in this case, it didn't work out for him. And ultimately, by the time he realized on Friday that he had to agree to what the Democrats were demanding all the while, you had sick outs at key air traffic control facilities that affected major airports in New York and Philadelphia and up and down the eastern seaboard. And you can imagine that part of President Trump, who is an owner of a 757 aircraft, probably thought to himself that if he were sitting on the tarmac at LaGuardia, as he would have been if he weren't president, he'd feel bad about it too.
Just in the nick of time. A government funding deal. Correspondent Stephen Portnoy at the White House, thank you.
You bet.
Even as the government prepares to reopen, it'll still be days before many federal workers get paid again. Correspondent Ed O'Keefe met some of them.
I do live paycheck to paycheck.
One paycheck from peril.
Sigrid Lane, furloughed for a month, now faces a more urgent reality.
As of today, I have $1.06 in my bank account.
$1.06.
That's how much I have. It's very terrifying when you look at your bank account, you have no money coming in, you don't know when you're going to get your next paycheck, and you're like, what do I do?
So far, her answer, get groceries at food banks and sell things off her own shelves.
The lamp, if someone wants to.
If somebody wants to buy it, they can buy it. That's just how desperate I am.
So desperate, Lane now fears losing her new home.
I just bought a new house, and I can't make my first mortgage payment.
She's not alone. After a 16-day government shutdown in 2013, 64% of federal workers said they had less than 2 weeks' worth of savings set aside. On the day before payday, about 20% of them had less than a day's worth of spending money in the bank.
In the last 40 years, we've had growing inequality in this country. And many families, many workers have barely seen their wages and incomes rise. So it's become increasingly difficult for them to pay for their basic expenses like housing and food and childcare.
A challenge facing furloughed workers like Jessica Appel, an executive assistant at the Department of Transportation. And because she's a contractor, Appel won't receive any back pay when the government reopens. Already facing a stack of unpaid bills, Appel found out when she went to the doctor that she and her 2-year-old son, Chase, lost their health care.
When I arrived, I was informed that my health insurance was not eligible. So I had to make the decision of paying out of pocket.
So Jessica's boyfriend took a second job at night, and she started this GoFundMe campaign, one of about 3,000 for federal workers that have raised more than $1.3 million. Meanwhile, Sigrid Lane is still stuck.
I went outside to start up my car, and my battery was dead. And the money that I had to pay for groceries, I had to pay for a car battery.
This distribution center that assists food banks across the Washington region tells us that they're set to serve about 600,000 more meals than usual this month. That's because of the government shutdown. Ed O'Keefe, CBS News, Washington.
The other big news this weekend, former advisor to President Trump, Roger Stone, arrested at the break of dawn at his home in South Florida Friday. Here's correspondent Nicole Killian.
Roger Stone emerged from a federal courthouse in Florida Friday and declared his innocence.
I will plead not guilty to these charges. I will defeat them in court. I believe this is a politically motivated investigation.
Stone is charged with one count of obstruction of an official proceeding, 5 counts of making false statements, and 1 count of witness tampering. The indictment goes into great detail about Stone's efforts to find out when WikiLeaks would release Democratic emails the Russians hacked during the 2016 presidential campaign. According to the court documents, a senior Trump campaign official was directed to contact Stone about any additional releases and what other damaging information Organization One had regarding the Clinton campaign. Special counsel Robert Mueller's team accuses Stone of trying to cover up his actions by lying and attempting to get others to lie for him. President Trump tweeted once again, calling the Mueller probe the greatest witch hunt in the history of our country. No collusion.
This has nothing to do with the president, has nothing to do with the White House.
Stone is the 6th Trump associate or advisor charged by the special counsel's office. The other 5 all pled guilty to various crimes.
It's very interesting to see the kinds of people that the president of the United States has surrounded himself with.
Some in Congress have renewed calls to pass a bill to protect Mueller's investigation from being shut down before it is finished. Nicole Killian, CBS News, The White House.
Coming up, the political crisis unfolding in Venezuela. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Non-essential U.S. diplomats are on their way out of Venezuela this weekend amid a growing conflict between the country's president, Nicolas Maduro, and the Trump administration.
Venezuela's military leaders pledged their support to President Nicolas Maduro a day after the U.S. recognized 35-year-old opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. There is no doubt Trump is trying to organize a coup d'etat in the country, Maduro said. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo pledged $20 million in humanitarian aid to the new government.
The tyranny of the now defunct Maduro regime has far too long,
choke the country and its citizens.
At least 14 were killed in clashes with security forces, according to a Venezuelan human rights group.
I mean, things are still dangerous.
Claudia Smolansky is a journalist in Caracas.
As I told you, I think people that are not scared anymore because they are tired and they want to reclaim their rights.
CBS News traveled to Caracas in 2017 during protests over Maduro's plans to rewrite the country's constitution.
¿Qué dices tú de esta elección? What do you say about this election?
Fraude constitucional.
Fraud. Constitutional fraud.
We also witnessed some of the more than 2 million Venezuelans who have fled to surrounding countries since 2015. 1 million alone live here in neighboring Colombia. Manuel Bojorquez, CBS News, Medellin, Colombia.
Preparations underway for another summit between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Here's correspondent Kimmy McCormick.
North Korea state media is reporting Kim Jong-un received a letter from President Trump from a North Korean envoy who held meetings here in Washington last week. President Trump has said a second meeting could happen at the end of February, but the two sides are still far apart on some fundamental issues. The nuclear negotiations have been stuck since last June's summit, though Kim has suspended nuclear and missile tests.
For the first time, reporters saw American Paul Whelan in custody in a Moscow courtroom as he was denied bail. Here's correspondent Elizabeth Palmer.
Reporters from around the world crowded into the Moscow court as he listened to the judge off camera deny him bail. He spoke to his lawyer and interpreter through a small slot in the prisoner's cage. Whelan was arrested in Moscow's Metropole Hotel for espionage, specifically having a USB drive containing state secrets. And in fact, that part is true, his lawyer told us in an interview. But Whelan didn't know what was on the drive. Someone had given it to him.
Who would have given him classified information?
It could be a mistake, he told us, or a setup. Anything is possible. Whelan had developed a fascination with Russia. He'd visited several times, had friends on the Russian Facebook, and was here in December to attend a wedding. There's a lot of speculation that that's when the Kremlin had him arrested for an old-fashioned spy swap. In return for Maria Butina, a Russian who recently pleaded guilty in Washington to being an unregistered foreign agent.
Now, that's something that the Russian government and Whelan's lawyer deny. Meanwhile, the lawyer says that if there's a trial, it's at least 6 months away, and Paul Whelan is likely to spend that time locked up in a Russian jail. Elizabeth Palmer, CBS News, Moscow.
As the U.S. pulls out of Syria, declaring ISIS dismantled and defeated, BBC Middle East correspondent Quentin Somerville embedded with Syrian defense forces on the front lines against what's left of the terror group in the town of Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria.
Utter ruin marks the Islamic State's retreat. In the hurry to get out, American airstrikes have jumped by a quarter. This has destroyed their strongholds, but no one here thinks they're truly gone.
We have defeated Islamic State many times, but they are religious extremists. Their ideology remains. Fighters are trying to escape with the civilians. They have sleepers in Syria, Iraq, and all over the world.
So IS are retreating into the shadows and to the desert west of here. There's still fighting to be done. Under the cover of more airstrikes, we join a night operation into the last Islamic State territory ahead. There's a mixture of bravado and fear. The fighters are men and boys from local villages and towns. They move at a cautious crawl. Some 2,000 IS fighters remain, including at least 20 British extremists. With homemade grenades and their bedding over their shoulders, they swagger on. Bit by bit, armoured bulldozers clear the way. But soon they get bogged down. They can go no further tonight. Syria is a country of constant mourning and near daily funerals. The family of 25-year-old Derek Khalil gather to mourn him. He died on the front line last week. It's the Kurds and Arabs who fought this war against IS and died in the thousands doing so. And before the battle is won, more will die. Some fought for revenge, and IS has been repaid in blood. Islamic State is almost beaten. Western troops will soon leave. These men and boys will again stand alone. It could prove to be a precarious victory. Quentin Somerville, BBC News, Deir ez-Zor, Syria.
Three men have been charged with planning an attack on a Muslim community in upstate New York. Police say the men and one 16-year-old had access to 23 firearms and 3 explosive devices when they were arrested.
You know, he's a good kid.
April Colinieri's 20-year-old son Brian is one of the 3 men arrested, accused of plotting an attack. Brian, along with 18-year-old Andrew Crissell and 19-year-old Vincent Vetramili, all face charges of weapons possession and conspiracy. A 16-year-old was also charged as a minor.
This is just not like him.
There was a plan to attack this community with weapons.
Police Chief Patrick Phelan said officers' first hint of the plan came from an alert high school student. That student, the chief says, overheard another student showing a suspicious photo and saying he looks like the next school shooter. Chief Phelan says further investigation eventually led to the plot to attack Islamburg, a rural Muslim community 200 miles away.
If they had carried out this plot, which every indication is that they were going to, you know, people would have died.
Police searched 5 locations, taking possession of 23 legally owned firearms, including rifles and shotguns. All 3 bombs were found at the 16-year-old suspect's home. Police also seized phones and computers from the suspects, which are now being analyzed at an FBI lab in Quantico, Virginia.
Anna Werner, CBS News, New York.
Up next, an arrest in the sexual abuse investigation of an incapacitated woman.
Police say the licensed practical nurse raped the patient and got her pregnant.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio presents the Intelligence Matters podcast, taking you inside the biggest stories in national security.
How concerned are you?
I'm concerned that the Russians never left.
Each week, former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, interviews top leaders from the U.S. intelligence community.
James Clapper, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, Mike Hayden.
And lucky for you, you won't need a security clearance to listen. The Intelligence Matters podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
A man has been charged with raping an incapacitated woman at a care facility in Phoenix. Here's correspondent Carter Evans.
Mr. Sutherland, you're here on one count sex assault.
Nathan Sutherland appeared in a Phoenix courtroom Wednesday to face charges of sexual assault and vulnerable adult abuse. Police say the licensed practical nurse raped the patient and got her pregnant. She'd been at Hacienda Healthcare since she was 3 years old.
We owed this arrest to the victim. We owed this arrest to the newest member of our community, that innocent baby.
Police were first alerted in December when a staff member called 911.
One of our patients just had a baby and we had no idea she was pregnant.
Ultimately, investigators asked for DNA samples from male employees at the facility, including Sutherland.
Did he cooperate initially when he was asked to give a sample?
My understanding is that he gave the DNA sample after he found that there was a court order which compelled him to give that. He did not volunteer to give a DNA sample.
I was shocked because I knew who the hell this guy was.
Karina Cecina, who says Sutherland worked overnights, moved her daughter from Hacienda after she found out about the incident.
I didn't notice anything. I didn't suspect anything.
In a statement, Hacienda healthcare officials say Sutherland went through an extensive background check when he was hired, and they added they're troubled beyond words to think that a licensed practical nurse could be capable of seriously harming a patient. Advocates for long-term care oversight are calling for action.
Due diligence needs to be done by the facilities as they're hiring staff. There needs to be better monitoring of staff in terms of making sure that residents are protected. It really does put us all on notice.
Police say Sutherland has no prior criminal record. Hacienda says they've increased security. The CEO has resigned along with a doctor, and another doctor has been suspended. An attorney for Sutherland said he pleads not guilty and he's going to get his own DNA test. Carter Evans, CBS News, Phoenix.
New fallout from the controversy of what appeared to be a group of Covington, Kentucky Catholic high school boys taunting a Native American protester near the Lincoln Memorial last weekend. More from correspondent David Begno.
Demonstrators led by Native American advocates gathered outside the Roman Catholic Diocese of Covington, Kentucky on Tuesday. They said they wanted to turn Friday's confrontation into a teachable moment. At one point, both sides appeared to reconcile their differences.
Let's sit down and have a cup of coffee. That's good. I'll buy a meal. We'll just figure this out.
It is high time!
Multiple videos have emerged of Friday's incident. Some show a radical group known as the Black Hebrew Israelites taunting a group of Covington Catholic High School students who had just participated in a March for Life anti-abortion rally. Native American activist Nathan Phillips walked in between the two groups. He says he wanted to defuse the situation. It was this moment between Phillips and Covington student Nick Sandman where some believe Sandman was disrespectful.
As far as standing there, I had every right to do so. My position is that I was not disrespectful to Mr. Phillips. I respect him. I'd like to talk to him.
The Twitter account that helped spread the initial video has been removed. The user, at 2020 Fight, claimed to be a teacher and an advocate named Talia from California. There was a photo appearing to show Brazilian model and actress Natalia Cardoso. In a statement, a Twitter spokesperson said deliberate attempts to manipulate the public conversation on Twitter by using misleading account information is a violation of the Twitter rules.
The lesson here is really to question what is the genuine source of this content, how is it being framed, and then how is that framing being elevated by the news media that you're looking through.
You know, lawmakers on the House Intelligence Committee and the Congress want to ask Twitter how that video came to be viewed so widely so fast. There was a thought initially that that Twitter account may have been opened in Brazil, but based on our reporting, it appears the account was opened in the U.S. and operated from here as well. David Begno, CBS News, Covington, Kentucky.
Among those expressing support for the boys, the White House. Teachers are back at school in L.A. following a week-long strike. Our Steve Futterman is in L.A. with more.
The strike ended up lasting just over a week. The two sides were finally able to reach an agreement following a marathon 21-hour negotiating sessions. The teachers will receive a pay raise. School officials have also agreed to reduce class size and hire more nurses and librarians. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
A setback in court for folks fighting for transgender troops.
Blake Dreeman is an active duty Navy lieutenant commander and is openly transgender.
I've deployed 11 times, two while I was transitioning.
He says he's disappointed the Supreme Court will allow the Pentagon to limit transgender military service, at least for now.
We go back to an effective don't ask, don't tell, where they can... They have to be in the closet.
Back in July of 2017, President Trump tweeted the military would not allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity, reversing an Obama-era policy.
We're ending the ban on transgender Americans in the United States military.
The administration can move forward with a revised version of its plan, barring transgender people unless they serve in their biological sex and do not seek to undergo a gender transition.
The high courts went 5-4. Along ideological lines to allow the policy to take effect while lower court legal challenges continue.
Reaction from critics has been swift. In a statement released Tuesday, DNC Chair Tom Perez said in part, "This ban is nothing more than bigotry codified into law and an insult to all who have worn our nation's uniform." Dreeman says the plan will not stop transgender individuals from serving their country.
As service members, we're trained to continue on and continue to serve, and we'll continue to do so until told otherwise.
The Pentagon maintains the policy is not a ban on service by transgender persons and said it's critical the department be allowed to implement personnel policies it determines are necessary. And Natalie Brand, CBS News, the Supreme Court.
Disgraced Hollywood mega producer Harvey Weinstein has unveiled a new legal team brimming with star power to defend him at his upcoming New York rape and sexual assault trial, but it's who they are that has at least one person crying foul.
They were just representing Weinstein accuser Rose McGowan, and now they're representing Harvey Weinstein.
She's now blasting former attorneys Jose Baez and Ronald Sullivan of being bought off by Weinstein and starting to represent him against sex assault charges. She pleaded no contest to misdemeanor drug possession just last week with the attorneys by her side. But when Weinstein lawyer Ben Brafman wanted out, the two started representing him just this week. Weinstein faces a May 7th trial, and McGowan calls their new gig a major conflict of interest. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, the downfalls of being a child prodigy.
Their childhoods may have produced amazing feats, but they too went on to live difficult, obstacle-filled, up and down lives just like the rest of us do.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
A smart pill with a smart nose. Here's correspondent Jim Shenevy.
Australian researchers have created a smart pill, a vitamin-sized pill that's packed with sensors and electronics designed to monitor the gases inside your body in real time, measuring hydrogen, carbon dioxide, and oxygen levels in the gut. Its developers say it could revolutionize treatment of gastrointestinal disorders, as well as to help diagnose a variety of conditions. Jim Shenevy, CBS News.
New concerns about another outbreak of measles, this time in Washington state.
Clark County, Washington is home to more than 6,000 public school students not vaccinated for measles. 23 cases of the illness are now confirmed, and that number could explode. Public Health Director Dr. Alan Melnick.
We have not seen any cases in vaccinated people.
The disease is so highly contagious that if one person has it, a person close by who has not been vaccinated is 90% likely to catch it.
When you have measles, you spread it through the air. So the person with measles can leave the room, and 2 hours later, the disease can be transmitted.
Over the last month, those infected told health officials they had visited the Portland International Airport, a Trailblazers home game, Costco, and IKEA stores, potentially exposing thousands. Doctors now worry the virus will spread to other hotspots across the country in large metropolitan areas like Seattle, Phoenix, Detroit, and Pittsburgh, where families can decide not to vaccinate their children due to personal, religious, or medical reasons.
What we're seeing here is preventable, and if we have one child die of this, that would be a tragedy.
Go. California resident Kelly Krueger wants parents to know what's at stake. Her son Uriah contracted the illness in 2015 before getting a second dose of the measles vaccine.
He was just kind of laying there lifeless for a good few days.
Jamie Yukis, CBS News.
We all want the best for our kids, but how much of an effect does parenting have on raising remarkable kids, geniuses in some senses, in music, acting, math, whatever? Ann Hulbert is author of Off the Charts, The Hidden Lives and Lessons of American Child Prodigies. Ann joins us in Washington. Ann, first off, what defines a child prodigy?
It is a term that is not as narrowly defined as you might think. There are some who would say children who do something at an almost or basically adult level by the time they are six. My book does not adhere to that strict a definition. I'm writing about kids who mostly do something that is remarkably mature and pretty much at an adult level before they are teenagers.
How unusual is it for children to display talents or abilities that are at a mature level?
Very unusual. I mean, that is not, you know, children do amazing things. When you think about what a one-year-old and a two-year-old learn in the course of 2 years, it's amazing. But to find a six-year-old who is playing, you know, Bach concertos, that is extremely unusual. To find a chess player at 14 who is winning, you know, world championships, that is unusual too. So it's very unusual.
So how much are they born gifted and how much does their upbringing have to do with it?
Part of what I was interested in exploring is the obviously murky question of nature versus nurture. And in the succession of stories in my book, you will find people arguing both sides. The first stories I tell about these two boys who were at Harvard at the ages of 11 as an undergraduate and 14 as a graduate student, their fathers were insistent that it was entirely a matter of nurture.
that their kids, though they were amazing, were models that anyone could follow. At the same time, across the United States in California, there was a psychologist named Lewis Terman, who is known for having brought the IQ test to America, who had discovered this quite amazing young child named Henry Cowell, who was an amazing musician. He was absolutely convinced that it was entirely nature. Nurture had nothing to do. Not that nurture had nothing to do with it, but that it was basically rooted in the child's genetic makeup. And yes, helpful tending early on would help it flourish, but the key was that inner nature.
You mentioned some of the children that you focus on in the book. You, in total, examine 16 kids over the last 100 years. Who stands out to you, and why did you choose this group?
Well, the reason I chose the characters I chose was based on an idea which was born out, which is that I wanted to focus on kids who stirred up public interest in them because their talents in some way spoke to concerns and hopes of their particular era. So I wrote about these boys at Harvard at the turn of the 20th century because this was a point at which the sort of old established elites were feeling a little anxious. These were sons of Russian immigrants. They were mathematical geniuses. This was going to be a century of technological and scientific progress. Everybody was interested. I talk about Shirley Temple in the Depression. She was this utter focus of the entire nation because she was this sort of bundle of underage confidence and upbeat optimism, which was exactly what the country sort of wanted to see. And she seemed to be an embodiment of what we wanted for, I mean, we Americans wanted for all of our children, and adults felt they needed. You know, I go on and write about computer, the very unusual precocious computer kids in the 70s at the dawning of the computer age. So my choices were based on this idea that we pay attention at particular times to particular unusual children because we're looking for clues to our own roots of raising our own children. So
what's the downside to all this? Because in these times, there's so much pressure on us as parents or as guardians and on children too.
Well, I think one of the things that these stories end up telling you is what we should all know, but we forget when we're raising our children, which is that a childhood is a short part of a life, and that super speedy mastery in childhood is not always a prediction of some mature flowering of a, you know, amazing sort. And what you can do in the process of focusing on that speedy mastery is lose out on what other things happen in childhood, which is a sense of autonomy, and you learn all kinds of things about the world that are not the specialized focus that is entailed in developing a, you know, one narrow talent. And I think the sort of awareness that you emerge, I hope, from my book, feeling about the stories of these different prodigies is how their childhoods may have produced amazing feats, but they too went on to live difficult, obstacle-filled, up-and-down lives just like the rest of us do. And many of them felt they had paid a high price for the specializing that they did early on.
Ann Hulbert on her book, Off the Charts, in studio in Washington here on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks, Ann.
Thank you.
Coming up, life after a year around the world.
I want to keep going. I feel like really, I feel really weird and antsy right now.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Jim Bridenstine, administrator of NASA. How close are we to space tourism?
I think we're very close.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
You think you've had an exhausting trip? Don't gripe about it to Jada Yuan. She's fresh off a year of travel for the New York Times, visiting its 52 places to go in 2018. Jada, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're in New York right now. What's it like adjusting to life stateside after all these months?
I'm not going to lie. It's weird. Going back to my apartment, nothing has really changed. Like, the paint is still chipping in the places that it was chipping before I left. And and the city, it still takes me longer to get anywhere on the subway than I guess that it's going to take me to get on the subway. Our street musicians are still really great. It's been an adjustment. Things are basically the same, and then I feel totally different and kind of at sea while I'm going in this familiar environment. But my parents are coming into town, so that's nice.
This was, no doubt, an exhausting trip for you. I've read your reports, some of your reflections on it. You've been everywhere from Chile to South Korea to the top end of Australia. What stood out for you about not only the places that you visited, but also the lessons that you may have learned along the way?
People were fundamentally nice to me everywhere I went, and I had a lot of reason to be suspicious or scared. A woman traveling on her own is rare. It's not something that I had done extensively before this trip. And certainly everywhere I went, at least in like the southern United States, people would say, be safe. And then it turned out that everyone said, be safe, basically across the world. It's this thing that I think is just a standard greeting, but also was meant for me as a woman traveling alone. And just over time, having to rely on strangers constantly to get me from one place to another, to help me find restaurants, I kept coming back to people being really nice. And all of the parts that were scary just sort of melted away. I wouldn't say that anyone should travel without a degree of caution, but it proved not to be so necessary in many situations.
What about all the things, though, that did go wrong for you? Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, I mean, I had lots of things that went wrong. Mainly, it was just arriving at an airport and realizing that I needed an outgoing flight to get into the next country. And I hadn't booked one. And my plane was leaving in five. They were going to close check into my plane in 5 minutes. And so I had to just like randomly choose a flight to Peru and be like, I guess that's when I'm going to Peru, so that I could get into the next place. It was always like having to think three or four steps ahead.
So it's not all scuba diving and sunsets.
No, but there were a lot of scuba diving and sunsets. And I think the other part of having a really rigorous, unrelenting travel and work schedule, because I was basically what was happening. I was like not only doing this big world trip, but I also had deadlines for the New York Times regarding writing and photos and video and all this stuff. So when you're doing that, I think you need to set aside some sacred time, which can be, for me, I think it was dinner was always sort of a time that I just didn't work. And I would maybe read or have a glass of wine. Also, like waking up for sunrises became something that I really loved to do. Or like if I was inside writing, running out and seeing the sunset.
And what did you do to fight exhaustion physically and also mentally?
Naps. Just like naps. It's kind of amazing. When you're traveling as long as I was, sort of time becomes malleable. And I wasn't getting mad about missing a bus. Like, I would get on the next bus. It was okay. Or if my bag was taking a long time to get out of baggage claim, like, good, I get to sit down and rest for a minute. But really, taking a nap whenever you feel like you need to take a nap is the best advice that I can give anyone who's trying to get through a really long project.
And I imagine a vacation for you then would be to stay at home.
Not at all. It's weird to be home when you've been in motion for as long as I have. And it feels a little bit like going backwards. And I feel like the trip changed me so much. It changed my perspective about what I was capable of. And I accomplished a lot. I wrote some at least 40 articles for the New York Times. I want to keep going. I feel like really, I feel really weird and antsy right now. And I would like to keep traveling. I think a vacation is more being able to stay in a place for more than 4 days and really get to know it.
New York Times 52 Places traveler Jada Yuan in New York, who's handing the reins of the job over to Sebastian Modak. Thank you, Jada.
Thank you so much.
Some Oscar nominations breaking new ground.
Marvel's Black Panther becomes the first superhero movie to earn a Best Picture Oscar nomination. The blockbuster is facing off against Roma, the first Netflix film to score a Best Picture nod. The movie from Mexico's Alfonso Cuarón earned 10 nominations.
I am the queen, but you are mad.
It's tied with the period comedy drama The Favorite for the most nods. Rounding out the category are A Star is Born, Green Book, BlacKkKlansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, and Vice. A Star is Born grabbed 3 acting nominations for Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper, and supporting actor Sam Elliott. Gaga goes up against Yalitza Aparicio from Roma, The Wife's Glenn Close, The Favorite's Olivia Colman, and Melissa McCarthy from Can You Ever Forgive Me? Some consider Bohemian Rhapsody's Rami Malek as the frontrunner for lead actor after winning the Golden Globe for playing Freddie Mercury. He squares off against Bradley Cooper, Vice's Christian Bale, Willem Dafoe, and Viggo Mortensen. Cooper, a first-time filmmaker, was snubbed for Best Director, but Spike Lee just earned his first nomination in the category after 30 years in the business.
Hello, this is David Duke.
His film, BlacKkKlansman, also earned a Best Supporting Actor nomination for Adam Driver. Chris Martinez, CBS News, Hollywood.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Jake Rosen is the intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.